Now it's my great, great pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, Ms. Tulsa Kinney. Tulsa Kinney is the editor and co-founder of Artillery, a contemporary art magazine based in Los Angeles. She received her MFA at USC and has participated in numerous solo and group art exhibitions over two decades. Previously a graphic designer at the LA Weekly, she began writing about the arts 15 years ago and has since been published in the Los Angeles Times and LA Weekly. Please give a very warm welcome to Ms. Tulsa Kinney.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to tonight's Zocalo MoCA event. Is art our last safe place? That is our topic of conversation with our three distinguished panelists, Karen Fiss, David McCarthy over there, and Aaron Toole. I want to talk about what we're going to talk about today a little bit, and then I'll give them a more of an introduction. So I'm Tulsa Kinney, editor of Artillery Magazine. You might have seen it out there. It's LA's contemporary art magazine in publication for 10 years now. So getting right to the matter at hand, I do think it's safe to say that artists have addressed disturbing and topical subject matter throughout history. And as illustrated in our image on the flyer for the Zocalo's event, you'll see Picasso's 1937 masterpiece, Guernica. And that is one of the most famous anti-war paintings of our time. So Picasso's not really known as a political artist, per se, but, you know, he's more well-known for starting an art movement, Cubism. But when the horrific bombing happened at Guernica, the artist felt a need to respond, obviously. So contemporary Swiss artist Thomas Hirschhorn, who has two shows here in L.A., he feels the need to make it his mission, shoving the world's malaise down our throats. His work is now showing here in L.A., one at MoCA, the installation. I don't know if you've all seen it. And then also he has installation at The Printed Matter. Or no, not The Printed. Mistake. What is it? Mistake Room, sorry. Okay, get all those mixed up. Anyway, his work is very raw and all about the message. But then on the other hand, you have important artists like Jeff Koons, you know, who makes, you know, balloon dogs and shiny art objects. So we're going to kind of talk about, you know, maybe the difference. Should Jeff Koons not be doing that, you know? So anyway, to lift from tonight's program, does art have a role to play in the society where violence is an ever more present reality? What truth can art show us now? So tonight we're going to explore that topic in a conversation, and allow me to introduce and welcome each of our panelists who have flown here specifically tonight to be with us. Karen Fiss in the middle. She's a writer, curator, and professor of visual studies at the California College of Arts in San Francisco. Her scholarship spans from books on fascist aesthetics and politics to contemporary art and the production of collective memory and nationalism. Her recent projects include the exhibition Necessary Force, Art in the Police State, and the exhibition Blue Flowers in the Catastrophic Landscape for the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid on the occasion of the 75th anniversary of Picasso's Guernica. Our other guest or panelist, David McCarthy, is a professor of art history at Rhodes College. He is the author of numerous books and essays on 20th century American art, including H.C. Westerman at War, Art and Manhood in the Cold War America, and I guess most recently, American Artist Against War, 1935 to 2010. And then Aaron Toole, right, is our only artist on the panel, or studio artist, and he is from Berkeley, is a Berkeley-based artist working in primarily with the cup. I think he'll explain a little bit later. His work is heavily influenced by his service in the Marine Corps during the 1991 Gulf War and his return to the civilian world. Since 2001, he has made and given away over 18,300 cups, mailing some to corporate and political leaders. And I got one tonight. So anyway.
I'm sorry I didn't bring that down.
So anyway, we're going to start this conversation and for about 35, 40 minutes, and we will open it up to audience participation. So I really do hope that all of you feel comfortable enough to talk about this very important subject. So we're just going to start off with the topic sort of at hand. What is the responsibility of the artist in light of the violence of our society today? Is it an obligation of the artist to address war in a time of war? So, Aaron, why don't you start off this conversation since you are an artist and a veteran?
All right, well, I think every artist, or hopefully everybody that has a vocation, or if they're called to do something, you know, they have to make their art, make their work. And so I think it'd probably be a bad idea to put the obligation on artists that they have to make any type of work, you know, that they should be speaking from an honest, sincere place. And for me, you know, having been through the Gulf War and then coming back and seeing how military is translated into civilian culture, and then have a whole other generation go back to the same place I was, I feel, you know, compelled to make work around that. But I definitely wouldn't, you know, enforce it on anybody else.
What about in the time, I mean, today, the violence, I mean, I do feel like artists should address this almost in some way. They sort of have a responsibility as far as kind of what is going on out there. I mean, I just kind of feel like, you know, I brought up Jeff Koons, you know, do we want him to start making shiny war guns? I don't know. Maybe it's not enough.
Well, there's just something in the statement that went out about this, you know, talking about the violence as if it was something new, you know, but right. I don't think there's ever been a time when America, well, there's been very few years where we aren't at war someplace, where there isn't, you know, I grew up in, used to be sunny South Central Los Angeles, and there was always violence there, you know, maybe not seeping into the suburbs more than it was before, but it seems like we've always.
You want to weigh in? You all write about, or
sure.
The artists that do.
What I would say is that the responsibility of artists is to be artists. You know, they have to make a decision about what they want to put in their art. Of course, they do other things as well. But if you are going to engage in thinking about war, whether through your art or through your activism, you know, it seems to me that carries certain responsibilities, one of which is to be informed, right? You know, what do we know about the world outside of our front door? Where are we getting that information? Do we trust that information? So I think embedded within this question of responsibility, which I would see as being synonymous with citizenship, is a high degree of skepticism, right? We know what we're seeing, what are we not seeing? We know what we're told, how might this be told differently? And that takes us in directions, perhaps, that aren't necessarily about making art directly, but that are really about making informed decisions about who we are and then how we want to act based on what we might be able to bring to this kind of a conversation. And thinking historically, the power of art has often been precisely to check what might be a drive toward war or a narrative about war under the control of government propaganda, or, as we all know, the way in which media may or may not report on violence from a particular perspective that might be open or honest or even necessarily complex, as these issues typically are. Artists then have, if not a responsibility, I think that's too much of a burden, I would say an opportunity to do what they do best, which is to think critically and also to translate that criticism into things that we can see that help us to process the world around us. You know, when they do that and do that well, it seems to me, then they're really playing an important role and giving us other ways of thinking and other ways of seeing.
Well, what about Karen? I mean, you did an exhibition on, I mean, yeah. Picasso felt the need to do Guernica. He's not really done other work, had he? I mean, you probably know more than I do, but he did feel like a need and maybe a responsibility, do you think?
Yeah, he certainly did other politicized works, but I think also Picasso's life is one of contradiction. He was also living in Paris during the occupation, the Nazi occupation. There's various historians who've researched his life during those years, fraternizing with Nazi officers. I mean, it's I think what gets dangerous is when one has kind of a black and white narrative about any artist's role or what their role should be vis-a-vis politics and war. And I think in terms of the Necessary Force exhibition was, because I was thinking more in line, not the exhibition. I was part of a curatorial team for the exhibition at the Reina Sofía on the 1930s, mm-hmm. which was to recontextualize Picasso's Guernica on the anniversary of the painting of the piece, but also the Spanish Civil War, and then also did a film exhibition. But the more recent project I did called Necessary Force Art in the Police State was mm-hmm. a project I co-curated the exhibition with Kim Pinder, who is also a writer and professor. And that was very much a reaction to the murders by police, predominantly of mm-hmm. men of color, young men of color. Mm-hmm. But we also were, I mean, before we decided to take on the project, we also talked about whether, in a sense, we were you know, we didn't want to actually, I think often now political content can actually be fashionable, you know, and we thought by the time our exhibition opened, maybe there would be, you know, 100 exhibitions. Mm-hmm. But it really started, we're very old friends, we've known each other for decades, and it started with very real conversations about, for her, what it means, she's African-American, what it means to be raising two black teenage boys, you know, who can't have their hands in their pocket, and just the anger and just our, both of our disgust with just the fact that, you know, since the Civil War, what, you know, what has really changed, and that was the motivation for the exhibition, was actually to bring a historical narrative to the issues and to slow down people's response to media imagery. I mean, a lot of the artists were responding to images that they had grown up with from the civil mm-hmm. Rights, did I say civil war? I meant civil rights era, mm-hmm. sorry. So we were actually pairing contemporary artists with well-known photographs from the civil rights era. Like Dred Scott and Hank Willis Thomas and Hedo Sterl and other contemporary artists. That work was very much seen within the context of photographs. And I think it also was very linked to the community. It was an exhibition in Albuquerque, which is the Department of Justice had moved in there in response to the incredibly bad record of the Albuquerque police force. So, I mean, it had a context. It was very much curated with, you know, public programming in mind of involving groups that are already very much involved in fighting police violence and the abuse of power. So anyway, it's a little off topic, but yeah, so I think the nuance and really thinking through the responsibilities as opposed to just representing.
Well, you know. I mean, Aaron, that makes me kind of think if you hadn't, but you being a veteran really sparked your interest in making your work specifically about that experience or war, correct?
Well, I mean, I got out of the Marine Corps and took the GI Bill and I was just following different classes. There's actually professors that I heard people respected, and I just followed professor to professor and ended up working with Ken Price at USC and doing ceramics. And, you know, I want to talk about actually Ben Sakaguchi at Pasadena City College is my first instructor after the Marine Corps, art instructor after the Marine Corps, and he said all art's political. That, you know, whatever you make, it's still in conversation with what's happening. And, you know, if the balloon, the stainless steel balloon.
Yes.
You know, those are welcome in places where my cups aren't, you know, mm-hmm. my cups and vice
right.
versa. So, I don't know. I just, you know, and for me, I want to talk about my experiences, and I took drawing and painting, but for me, it didn't feel like the right scale, that the, you know, the intimacy or the, you know, the hand-to-hand thing of from my hand to your hand and talking about one little thing. They don't show well on TV. They don't make mm-hmm. big broadsides.
It's
they experience best, you know, hand to hand. And that's, I think, where the most powerful thing I've seen in my work is it's not me saying something, it's me handing it to somebody who was in the Korean War and recognizes the images on the cups, and they tell a story to somebody, you know, to a daughter or a brother or a longtime friend. They tell their story, and the cup is just a touchstone for the conversation. You know, it's not the cup, it's, you know, what the people bring to it. Mm. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Well, I mean, it did. I mean, I just am wondering, David, have we heard from you? I mean, you're drawn to political art. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you kind of just poo-poo, you know, minimalist art, decorative work, abstract art?
Well, you know, I'm a trained art historian, and I get paid to teach art history, so I don't poo-poo any art, okay? You know, if artists didn't do their work brilliantly, I wouldn't have a job. So the artists in the room, thank you. But that said, I think one of the challenges in the last 200-odd years, as we've moved into this construct we call modernism, is thinking about how artists find their place within their world. Right, considering the fact that old sources of revenue dried up, royal families no longer needing art because there weren't that many royal families, Catholic churches being filled with all the frescoes they need, you know, and then a market opening up and the pressures that come with a market about what's saleable, what's not saleable. And that puts artists, I think, in a difficult situation of having to pay the bill and at the same time having to be honest to their muse. Right, mm-hmm. And some artists decide to make decisions based on what their revenue is or where their heart is or what their politics are. And I think that gives us a much more complicated notion of what art has been and what it can be. But if you're asking me about what I write about, I write about art that's engaged with its world. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned my H.C. Westerman book. World War II veteran, Korean War veteran, saw extensive combat, and then spent the rest of his life periodically reflecting on what it was like to be a Marine, right? And he didn't come to the conclusion that World War II was the good war, that he was part of the greatest generation. He rarely talked about Korea because that was so traumatic. And yet, the art became his means of therapy. And it also became a means of putting that experience indirectly, albeit because it's a work of art, he's not living it again, putting that experience out into the world for other people to consider. And that becomes a focal point for thinking about the profound violence that he had experienced, both as a person wielding the heavy weaponry of modern war, and also a person who was on the opposite end of heavy weaponry, and knowing that he was profoundly vulnerable and lost people around him who he loved dearly. And because that's now part of the historical record, when this work does get shown, which is not always, because I think it's difficult to look at, unless you want to periodize it, which I think reduces its historical significance, if we're open and honest with the works of art that take a stance about difficult issues, war is one, racial violence is another, I think art can serve a pretty powerful social function. You know, we're asking this question about, you know, is art a safe space? Maybe not in that academic sense, but maybe what art is an opportunity for community building, maybe in that immediate circle of two people in front of a work of art, or 20 or 200 or whatever it's going to be. And if the art becomes a conduit, then something happens that I suspect doesn't happen as often as we like to claim it does within our democracy, that points of view are being shared. Right? But that's not the question you necessarily asked me, but I think there is a role to be played if artists choose to play that role, and I think we're better for it when they do.
But it does feel like it's got to be something sincere. You know,
Yeah, absolutely.
The social practice thing for students, and a lot of times, you know, they just want to parachute into communities and, yeah, I'm going to knit everybody on Skid Row pink sweaters. Yay! You know, like, wait! You know.
Yeah.
So I think that it's important that the, like you said, educated about the issue, yeah, and then that there's a sincere or that they build a connection with the community they're trying, mm-hmm, to, yeah, interact with.
Well, there, I keep thinking of, Mike Kelly, who's not with us anymore, but he was a very dedicated, I would say conceptual artist that did really incorporate politics in his art a lot. And if he would see you know, I might bring up somebody's art, I won't say it, but they were kind of like, he'd say decoration, and the word, you know, the D word, decoration. And, you know, I kind of feel like in postmodernism and conceptual art, are you doing your job if you are making just decorative work? I mean, I still very much respond to, you know, beautiful art. I mean, I will say I could stand in front of Pollock out there, you know, for, you know, well, minutes, maybe not hours, but, you know. So, I mean, I still think there's place for that, but maybe. But that's Jackson Pollock we're talking about, you know, in the 50s, you know. Now we're talking about, you know, maybe, I mean, art changes through, you know, different eras, epochs, and everything. I mean, so maybe today it is a responsibility, and that is what we're talking about. And but one of the things I did want to keep going, or respond.
I think it's David and Aaron have kind of addressed the dangers of being prescriptive about, in a sense, taking up politics. And within the art world, it would also be what would be considered a politically correct. I mean, being probably against the Iraq War, being against, you know, there's very few exhibitions that after we invaded Iraq were, you know, at MoMA celebrating. So there is a certain liberal bent, obviously, I think, to much of the art world, although that often hides, I think, a deeply conservative impulse within the art world as well, which is to maintain the status quo. I mean, museums may begin to diversify their collections, maybe showing artists who are politically engaged either with their own identity politics or, but still the structures, the economic and political structures of the art world haven't shifted all that much. So you know, I still go to meetings or wherever that, you know, the demographics of who's running the museums, who's curating, and that all has to do also with maintaining value. So I think something that we haven't really talked about is, you know, the commodity value of a work and what happens when something that is done sincerely or meant as protest ends up being acquired. If you lose control of the work, I know having worked with Hans Hacke on an exhibition years ago, that became a big concern of his, is just how his work would be exhibited and used in the future. So I think it's really beyond just the content. So much of it has to do with the reception, and certainly now with social practices, where the social is actually the medium that many, particularly young artists or program. I know my college has a social practices program. That is a deeply complex area that can actually have a fairly imperialist or colonial case that I think people are becoming more sophisticated and aware about. But yeah, I think, you know, I think Guernica, for example, I brought up Picasso's, you know, checkered other, you know, Gertrude Stein as well. I mean, there's a lot of modernist heroes that if you look closely, Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, fascist politics. I mean, we always assume that modernism is somehow liberal. It's not. You know, there's a lot of modernist artists who were deeply enamored with fascist politics. It was a youth movement. It was, you know, against the status quo. But Guernica nevertheless stands as something that continues to inspire people. I met a woman who was looking at the way that Guernica had been recreated in various communities globally, you know, whether it was in tapestry and the way that it's still somehow, that's, you know, a utopian notion, I think, for anyone who wants to continue believing in the modernist notions of...
It's also in Phineas and Ferb.
Yeah.
Disney cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I guess we were going to talk about, you know, the title of this panel is Art Our Last Safe Place? So I think we were all a little confused how we might interpret that. So I thought maybe we could throw that around, like safe as in, does it have healing qualities? you know, is it healing when, you know, we communicate, you know, stop the war, stop the violence, stop the racism, stop the one percenters. So is that the safe place that we're talking about? I mean, can art actually make a difference, I guess? And also, I wanted to talk about the safe place.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the terminology, safe space, for us came kind of out of this recent newsworthy academic, you know, University of Chicago writing its freshman. So maybe that's just David and I coming from academic context. But
yeah, I mean, you know, it's a moment right now. And I don't want to dismiss the moment at all. I think students increasingly are coming into our classrooms who have experience that is that many of us have never had. And I think the concept of the safe space is in one sense a means of talking to faculty who are sometimes ignorant about where our students are coming from. I think it's easy to demonize this or trivialize it because it can be picked up and kicked around as a kind of catering to the young students primarily who come through a classroom. And yet I think that we sometimes, in framing it in such a fashion, you know, forget that experiences are varied. At the same time, you know, when students say they don't want to encounter Shakespeare, they don't want to encounter Picasso, you could pick anyone who deals with complicated and tough issues, then safety becomes a kind of cocoon. So I wrestle with this in my own teaching, and I tell the students that I think the safest place we have is honesty itself, which means we have to confront these things, especially if we're reading or we're looking at things that take us in areas where maybe some of us have never been before, or maybe where we're going to see things radically different in the classroom. And if in that encounter we begin to learn something both about the art and then about one another in this conversation, then that safe space is an opportunity for a lot of growth. And I don't want to trivialize this by saying it's a teaching opportunity or a learning opportunity. I don't want to make it utilitarian in that way. Rather, I think it's an opportunity for empathy. And I think to come back to Guernica, which we're all talking about as a frame of reference, one of the things that makes that painting so powerful, if one's open to that painting, right, and forgets its art historical status, is that it is still a deeply wounding painting. If you're in front of it and think seriously about what Picasso wanted us to experience and think about, even now, so many years after the bombing in 1937.
I just laugh. You know, the Guernica, that's a great piece, and it's strong, obviously, but, you know, like, I've been conscious of that piece my whole art career or whatever, and not saying that my art is going to change the world, right? Because, you know, Hiroshima and Auschwitz and all that came after Guernica was painted, Fallujah. You know, so if I set myself up that I'm going to change the world, you know, I think I'm setting myself up to fall. So my comfortable artist statement is I just make cups, you know. But the also bigger than that, I think, is like, you know, I don't think anything I do is going to change the world, but nothing in the world releases me from my obligation to try. And it's in, you know, in trying a sincere and honest, like, baby steps, you know, little bit at a time. And it seems really impotent in the face of all this other stuff going on, but I don't know what else to do. And I think the cup is the right scale. Like, actually looking at the Hirshhorn piece upstairs, there's an image in there that I know I put on a cup in color. And it was really weird. I mean, it was uncomfortable seeing it up there, and it's uncomfortable seeing it on a cup too, but I don't know, there's something, the hand-to-hand, like where it's big broadcast like that versus the hand-to-hand. I'm pretty sure if the person that took that photograph is the person that killed that person, they don't need the photograph, that they'll have that in their head for the rest of their life. You know, it's the rest of us that don't have that experience that maybe need to see it, but I don't know what's the best way, you know, to show those things. From Babylon, but
no,
there was a photojournalist speech at UC Berkeley, and the guy came on, he said, "I've wasted my life." He was the senior guy, and he said, "You know, I thought if I showed the world these images, the Vietnam War would stop. But if anything, you know, now it's entertainment, you know, and so." I get nervous and babble, you know. So.
Well, you're not babbling. We have this idea of safe. I mean, we were talking about if it is means the safety of, you know, not being censored or, you know, being, like, if we want to talk about Thomas Hirshhorn, but...
I don't want to be cynical, but I think the art world, I think we're far beyond thinking that the art world reflects something differently about society. I think it very much is a case-to-case basis. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes you can get away with something mm-hmm. in the space of art. I remember when I was first starting out, I worked at the ICA in London, and Christoph Wodisco did a piece where he projected a swastika on the South African embassy. This was before the end of apartheid. And the police, it was sponsored by the ICA, and the police came within, I think it was within 24 hours and, you know, made them take it down. But I was thinking, you know, when I was young, like, that happened because an art space was able to make that happen. It made a statement. I don't know how many people saw it. But I think my notion of what is political and what is effective has changed because I'm more aware now of that spectacle, of the compassion exhaustion. I mean, Thomas Hirshhorn's obviously engaging with, you know, our intense media saturation. I know there's been a lot of discussion now about actually being able to watch the retaking of Mosul online and, you know, the Gulf War being the first one to be broadcast. I mean, so there's changes. There's the thresholds of representation keep advancing. And I think that actually changes us psychologically, emotionally. So I think we have to be really, again, a very case-by-case basis to actually say that the art world is where, you know, this discourse can still be safe. Sometimes the art world can shut down discourse. I think one of the reasons Kim and I wanted to put together Necessary Force, as I said, was to create a place of discussion, of discourse, and historical hindsight. I think, you know, often images are more a source of amnesia and denial than actually informing, you know. So I think that's kind of what Aaron was saying too. But.
Okay, I'm not sure we answered that question, did we?
We keep jogging.
Well, but I mean, it's obviously artists do deal with political issues, obviously. We don't know if it provides a safe space. I don't think we will be able to answer that question, maybe. But I was wondering, I mean, we were talking about Thomas Hirshhorn's installation, and it is here, and it is at the, why do I keep wanting to say Printed
Mistake
Matter?
Room.
The Mistake Room. I don't know why I keep saying that. And, you know, he is shoving it in our face. And I have to say, when I walked through both exhibits, you know, I saw both of them. And then even just walking through MoCA the other day, if I think about what really kind of made an impression on me as mm-hmm. I left, I would say that that particular installation did kind of. Well, it might be because I know I'm supposed to be thinking about it too. But I mean, I know it did. It was horrific to me. There was images that were very hard to look at. And, you know, he also throws in, if you haven't seen it, he throws in an artist, her name's Emma Koons, and she was known for like doing kind of those spiroglyphics kind of, or mandala, or those, whatever those are called, I forget.
Mandala.
Yeah. Anyway, she claimed they had healing properties. I mean, like, she really did, and believed that, and Thomas Hirshhorn put them in his installation. Now, we don't know if he did that as a remark on, that's ridiculous, you know, that's not going to heal anything, your art. Or, you know, but is that the safety place that he, is that, you know, why did he put that in there? Is she believed her art really did have healing properties. And so I just wondered, you know, is his art does it turn the audience off, or does it, you know, it reinforces, horribleness of war? I just kind of wanted to know if what you think about, you know, like you saw that today. What feelings did come from you? What did it evoke?
I don't want to talk about another artist.
Okay, but you can tell me about your feelings.
Sure, sure.
About how you felt.
Having used some of the same images on my own work and putting them in public, and when I first started, people were like, oh, why are you making this? Actually, my first gallery show in Los Angeles, the guy said, I'm going to give you this show, even though your work isn't relevant to anything that's happening in Los Angeles. And it was all military stuff and letters to the Pentagon, the White House, and the show opened the month after 9/11. And people were like, oh my God, your work is so timely. I was talking about the Gulf War 10 years ago, but whatever. But still, and so now going forward, now there's another war or wars, and those same images, but, you know, and is it healing? No, I don't think it's healing, but it does start a conversation. And I think that, like, for the cups anyway, I know that they've started conversations where a daughter will ask for a cup for her father, and that starts something. And, you know, those, a lot, people who've, you know, seen those images firsthand, you know, smelled it firsthand, it's a really different thing, you know, and they don't want another, they don't need a souvenir cup for that, you know. But for their kids, it might help, you know, bridge, you know, be the touchstone to have that conversation about unspeakable things, you know. And in that, there might be something, you know, valuable, but it's got to have that audience participation, or that, you know, that other, you know, that somebody who responds to the work, who knows what the work's about, I think, to start the healing in it. And I think, too, like, it can't, like, it's messed up to say, but in some level, like, 9/11 was comforting to me, you know, because I went to the war and I came back and now I'm this crazy person. And then when 9/11 happened, I was like, there you go. That's what war is like. Mm-hmm. You understand now? And it, you know, it made me feel less insane. But no, we're all crazy.
Well, how about, do you, you saw the both of the exhibits. I mean,
yeah,
is it a turn off or a...
Like, I mean, in my professorial role, I would ask my students, is he aestheticizing images of war? Is he exploiting political content for an artwork that is sold for a lot of money? Is he reproducing the spectacle in a De Boer sense? Is he reproducing our growing immunity to, you know, repetition of images of horror? Is he actually calling awareness? I actually was up there, I flew in just this afternoon, so quickly went to see the piece again. And just started asking people who would come into the room, like, what do you think this is about? I was just curious, you know? I mean, what's the, you know, the non-October crowd? Because he's the darling of, you know, that he's the political artist for, you know, Hal Foster and Buchloe and Claire Bishop. And he reads all the same texts I do. You know, it's really comforting to see all my texts. See, students, you know, this is, I told you, you should read this. I find it, so, and I have talked to him. I believe that he's doing work that he believes in. I don't, you know, but I have serious questions about that kind of work versus, and someone like David Joslett has argued that he's really transforming our relationship with those images to one of witnessing, where you're not in a separate time, but you're in of that time. And I feel that's fancy rhetoric. In my graduate work, witnessing and testimony was all the rage in Yale's comp lit department. But I actually don't feel it's accurate. And I think actually more what Aaron's talking about of a real exchange, not one that is staged, it really, I mean, in an immersive way, but again, I don't think it breaks out of those conditions of spectacle, that one-way conversation that De Boer describes at all. I still feel that's intensely relevant when it comes to his work. So I personally don't fall on the side of somehow that's, I mean, I think it's horrifying to look at. I also have some questions about the use of the Congolese sculptures, you know, and the sort of deliberate use of, you know, the primitive. One person said to me, it's very biblical. He felt like, you know, we're always healing and destroying. And, you know, he was kind of taking a a general, just a spectator who was in there today, that it was kind of a reflection on just what humanity is about. But it wasn't really about, these are, you know, Iraqis who were killed in this war. This is, you know, a soldier. You know, that mm-hmm. there was, they were still dehumanized. Mm-hmm. And I feel, you know, once that happens, I don't feel there's anything in the installation, at least for me, having read those same texts that people are reading in order to champion his work. And then there's, of course, all his monuments that are in neighborhoods, you know, that mm-hmm. he doesn't necessarily live in, which, again, gets to that social practice issue. What does it mean to go work and pay people $12 an hour to help build your Gramsci monument or your... Anyway.
I guess two comments. And this is not to criticize the museum. I wonder what it would be like not to have that little warning label before you walk in so you just get a cold.
That was also interesting. Yeah.
And again, this comes back to how much we in the United States really don't know about war. I mean, you travel the rest of the world, you're on battlefields, right? I mean, I've lived in the South now for 25 years. Shiloh is not that far away. Vicksburg is a longer drive. But if you replicate Sherman's March to the Sea, I mean, that's a landscape of devastation. But it has a narrative behind it. And we have a lot of monuments in the United States, but monuments, for lots of reasons, are designed to be forgetful, right? And as much as I would rather forget that period of 2001 to 2008, and then of course it hasn't really ended in some significant ways, what I value about Hirshhorn's piece is the onslaught of information that, at least to a certain point, was seductive before Americans became profoundly aware of what was happening with the prison abuse scandal and photographs of people, with veterans coming back and talking in ways that I suspect veterans have talked in the past, but that the culture wasn't ready to hear. So for me to go back to that piece was to be reminded of that decade and that moment. And if it can continue to resonate in that way, then maybe there's a takeaway that's not just about art, but about how easy it is to be distracted when a country claims to be at war but hasn't mobilized or so carefully manages a war narrative. So I'm a slightly different place on that installation, mm-hmm. I think, than my colleagues here on stage.
Yeah. I'd say that my roots are also just, there's really around the status of the image and what the image means in our current society and how actually the nature of it has changed. And, you know, this historically, I mean, in our contemporary media times, this was a big debate between Claude Lanzmann and Georges Didi Huberman over images of the Holocaust, of the few images actually were shot secretly in Auschwitz, about when is it appropriate to exhibit an image, what happens to it once it's exhibited. Mm-hmm. Another example is Doug Nivens and Chris Riley went into the archives of Twelve Slang and printed photographs of the Khmer Rouge before they murdered or assassinated their political prisoners. They took a photo of them first with their little prisoner number in Cambodia. And that was kind of a record keeping. And we know who the photographer was. There's been interviews with this photographer. But basically, they went into the archives, found those negatives, made sure the negatives were stable, and printed those portraits, and then published them in a book about the killing fields, and then also had a couple of editions that had their copyright on the back that have been sold to museums. You know, there's one in the collection of MoMA, and those photographs and then start becoming part of other exhibitions. So I feel the debate that we learn about thresholds of representation, mm-hmm. that come out of Holocaust studies is extremely important in terms of notions of dehumanization and what happens in an art context to these images of, you know, crimes against humanity, of murder, of the end of, you know, human life. And I think, yeah, I feel that the Hirschhorn piece doesn't, you know, it's just not in that rhetorical space, and it's very rhetorical, that that I feel is more productive to mine.
Well, okay, it sounds like we actually are beginning to get more into the conversation, but we are going to open this up.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I just had a question. I'm going back to the title of the panel. To me, I guess it means, does art give us a space to talk about things that we can't talk about just by seeing the news, or think or feel things that we might not feel just by getting something on the news or having a conversation with a friend? And I just love to hear from the panelists what you think about that.
One of you answer it.
Wow, we all misunderstood.
Does someone want to take a stab at it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think what I value in Aaron's work is that it takes it out of the digital dehumanized realm, and and art can totally dehumanize and not,
say the C word.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's craft.
Yeah, craft.
It's crafty. I mean, I went to art school, but it really was the thing that resonated to me was the hand-to-hand aspect of it, and like sharing that. And shoot, you talk about how art or images get interpreted and used for propaganda or whatever, but like the cup lasts 500,000 to a million years, you know, from my hand to your hand. And then, and that's the interesting thing to me, like, you know, if it's art, it's got to be the audience, you know, that's what makes it cool, is when somebody like gets it, and or even just to spend the time to actually pick up a cup and look at it. You know, and like going to the Louvre and watching people just like, Mona Lisa saw it. Okay,
yeah.
You flew from, you know, without spending any time with it. And so I think, you know, for it to be elevated, it really takes, you know, people participating and viewing. And
like I was just going back and forth by email. I wrote an article on a transgender performance project in Berlin, and then there's just another show about like thinking of strange genitals and just, you know, rethinking gender. I think, you know, the art world can actually be a place, certainly more so now, where again, people can have a space to perform identity or to push the boundaries of like social, you know, control or stereotype. But it can also just as easily shut that down. I mean, have we forgotten about the NEA and Jesse Helms and the defunding of the arts? And I mean, I think again, what's so dangerous now, aside from like the lack of history, because the past doesn't stay in the past, it's like a zombie. It just keeps, you know, it can pop up tomorrow. It can pop up on your, you know, your stream. It can, there's a mistake of opinion for really nuanced understanding of how complex everything is. So people get so entrenched in their politics that they fail to actually be able to meet. I mean, that's, in a sense, it's the end of the commons. And in some ways, the commons was a form of control and homogenization. But on the other hand, it was also a place where actually discourse could happen, that was, you looked in someone's eyes and, you know, there's some kind of relational and human aspect that I think art can still potentially play that role.
Yeah, I think we tend to forget the importance of imagination. We forget how powerful it is, we forget how resilient imagination is, we forget how radically disruptive imagination can be, right? And I think art gives us that, which can stand outside then of these other interests, right, that have a stake in controlling the flow of information. And I think the other thing, too, that in politics, because in some ways the United States just isn't very good at it, when you think about it, it's so easy to just to say, yeah, that's your opinion, which is a way of containing somebody else's thought process. Mm-hmm. But a work of art's an actual thing. You know, whether no matter how it's conceived, right, there's thought that's in it, there's craft that goes into it, somebody's taking the time to put it together, right? So there's an investment in it. Right, and I think because of that, it carries a kind of weight that I think sometimes we forget stands behind it. And at least for me, that means it's something that I have to devote time to, right? And in devoting time, I am forced to break out of whatever my positions happen to be, whether or not I agree with what the artist is trying to say in their work. And I find that potentially liberating and transformative. I may not agree, but at the same time, because there's something there for me to deal with, I then carry that responsibility of dealing with it.
My name is Haik, and I just riffing off of the first question, I feel like that we have a recognition that art potentially can be a safe place, art making, art spaces, cultural spaces, but we also recognize how much it's endangered in being co-opted by forces to be towards that. So like we kind of, I feel like you all addressed, on the sides, capitalism and neoliberalism, and specifically left-wing neoliberalism, are forces that very clearly, in my mind, are there to co-opt arts and artist spaces. Mm-hmm. And I guess, not to make it a long question is, how can artists, individual artists, who are by and large oftentimes completely dependent on funding from sources that very much dictate and narrate themes, how can we help individual artists have spaces where they can do what we know arts and artists can do, which is be creating and opening these conversations that go beyond entrenched neoliberalist politics?
It's a longer process, right? It's not like the meteoric rise, did I say that word right? You know, it's not like the big, like, oh, I'm here, art world, you know, but just keep making, you know, and don't go into crazy debt, and you know, and help your buddies out, and don't get nasty with your peers, you know, like, we're the one, you know, like, that's so important, like the help from peers and, you know, turning each other on to opportunities, you know, like, I'm not gonna win the bathing suit contest, so I can turn that on to somebody else, you know, like, we can, but, you know, but I think we should not see each other as, you know, competitors, but, you know, it's as teammates, kind of, or, you know, I don't know.
Are you saying also kind of like you feel like these artists that do work with, you know, political issues and things like that, that they don't have an opportunity to, like, make a living off their art because it's so political and not, you know, is that sort of what you're kind of asking? Do you like
certainly, that's part of it. I feel like there are so many sides to it. I was curious what each of you perhaps feels more strongly about addressing that in academia. You know, how do we expose artists who are coming to be to things that maybe directly oppose academia and the problematic parts of academia while being in academia? I don't know if that's even possible. there are many sides. And of course, making a living as an artist, you know, artist proximity to capitalism, whether they are making art, living as an artist or making a living doing something else, because that actually can open up themselves.
I mean, and that is the deal. The parties, like, you know, introduced, like, I'm the lab tech at UC Berkeley. I load the kilns. You know, I'm an artist. I got work in museums. You know, it's not, I don't know. But academia, that's you guys.
Yeah, but as we already know, it depends on the institution, right? It depends on comfort level, right? It depends on how much latitude your gallery director has to do what they want to do. One of the interesting things about writing that book on the history of anti-war art in the United States was that there's this long tradition of college and university spaces showing work that wasn't being shown elsewhere. But that's also, you know, it means, is your dean comfortable with this? Is your board of trustees weighing in one way or another, because they want balance, right? Which can mean a lot of different things. How do you handle the press when you've got a firestorm about something in your gallery? I mean, we just showed in our gallery at Rhodes, an exhibition of activist art. Dred Scott was there. We had the flag, right? You know, a man was lynched by police yesterday. And the school made a decision. that they were, you know, because Memphis is predominantly an African-American town. We have a strong Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, the school did a lot of reaching out to talk about how to do this, knowing that some people are going to be upset. It's one of those moments when things worked out. You know, it seems like other moments, especially when it involves sex, where some people don't want that in a gallery. Even though it's taught in gender studies courses, it seems to have a different valence when it's a work of art. So it gets complicated. I mean, I think it's if academia is going to be a bastion of academic freedom, then it has to be, but it isn't always, right?
I just wanted to bring up the issue of oversimplifying what is political or not political art, because we have to first define what is political. So if what is political is the way we stage and shape and give meaning to ourselves, then art is inherently interrogating that. And to talk about the dehumanization, I think that to say an artist isn't being political because it's not in your face political, maybe it's achieving the same thing through a different means. And so the idea of a shift in thinking can occur through that aesthetic experience, maybe in a non-traditionally political way, and kind of see what you guys thought about that.
I mean, for sure, I think any, you know, it's sincere, you know, like you, whatever you're doing. I mean, I think like in medicine and business, everything could be good and noble and sincere and make the world a better place, you know, but yeah, of course, there's, I mean, I thought about that for a while, like, hearing a critique of my wife's work and a critique of my work, and I was like, I'm gonna present my wife's work as my work and see what the instructor says to me. Like, you know, and vice versa, but, you know, because I know they were just dismissive and said all kinds of stupid things that, like, they wouldn't say to my face anyway, you know, like, but sure, of course, I think, you know, support it, and, but I think what I'm talking, it's, I mean, okay, so, but, you know, it takes a lot to make big stainless steel balloons. And the people, like, I kind of live in fear, where'd you go, that, like, the Koch brothers are going to get really turned on by my work. And, like, right. That, like, you know, like, and I give, you know, as much as I can, if I had the cups in the room, I'd give them all, you know, I'd give you each one. If the Koch brothers won't, they got to pay. They got to pay a lot of money, you know, like, but it would really make me, I mean, even getting into museums kind of freaks me out, like, is my work so impotent that...
You'd put a self-destruct thing
on. Yeah. It's in the glaze.
Yeah, exactly.
I might.
Once the check is clear.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Well, I think a lot of artists have compromised, you know, sometimes their, you know, real, you know, heart of the matter with their art, maybe when it comes to, is this work going to sell or not? I'm sorry, that's kind of a fact of life in art, in the art world, a little bit.
When, again, where the guy went, but... Because I give my work away, commercial, like I showed my work at a commercial, the gallery owner said, your work is strong, but what's for sale? And I said, well, there's more to art than money, right? And she said, not much. And I love her for her honesty, you know, but like it's turned out that like I work with museums and schools and nonprofits, and they're lovely people, and they're not, you know, they still have to get donors and funding and stuff, but like it's a totally different scene than trying to, you know, work in a commercial gallery. And so it's another option. And maybe, you know, it's not the one true art world, but, you know, the one true art world is run by the same people that run the one true pharmaceutical companies. And the
well, it's five U.S. galleries that are basically responsible for most of the, you know, one-person shows that happen in the United States and museums. So, but I completely agree with you. I think, actually, the art world can and often is very prescriptive. And that has to do with trends and markets that we're still not honest about. And I mean, there is another, you know, again, looking for, you know, theoretical discourses like around Jacques Rancière, who draws a lot from Frankfurt School, but notions of rearranging the sensorium, and there's other ways of you know, thinking about aesthetics and politics. And for me, I actually feel politics is a subset of aesthetics because everything is about the image now. So I'm not super, we were talking about, I mean, a lot of my work is, you know, it's about fascism, and I've been working a lot in Vietnam and South Africa, you know, apartheid. I'm it's all work that's really trying to make sense of memory and trauma, and I mean, it speaks to my own history. Both my parents were Holocaust survivors, you know. So it's important, like, or is a conversation, whether it's, you know, representing it or just actually experiencing art in some way that changes me, whether, you know, it's, but I am fairly cynical about what happens once the art world gets a hold of stuff. I guess I've just been in it for a long time, and, you know, when I was younger, I expected something different. So, but it's still possible. It's not, you don't do it because of that.
A lot of the it's some kind, you know, so I'm political art, but it's also veterans art. Every November, I'm in a show. You know what I mean? It's not, I'm not an artist, I'm a veteran artist. And so I get calls and the groups, you know, hey, you're in this show too. Hey, did you get that announcement? You know, like, it's this click that we're all, and we're, you know, and we've talked about it amongst ourselves, like how to break out of that or how to open it up. You know, because I feel like a lot of the same things that let us drop bombs, you know, in third world countries, let us send kids to prison for $50,000 a year for, you know, with no return on that investment. Like, well, it's not me, it's not, you know, it's somebody else.
Well, the private prisons are actually getting quite a good return on their investment.
Well, I meant us.
Yeah.
The taxpayers.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're paying the money without any. Yeah. We're like, you know, 20 grand on the education, that's too much. Why should we pay for that? But 50 grand for prison.
Yeah.
Well, he's a monster. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, that's actually going to conclude our program. We've run out of time.
On a real uplifting note. Okay,
really uplifting note. But no, you can ask them any more questions you have upstairs in our reception. Grab a glass of wine. They're all going to join us up there. I want to thank MoCA for partnering and co-presenting this program with us. We're so grateful for their existence and for being here and partnering with us. And thank you guys for giving us your time and your energy and thoughts tonight. Let's give them a big round of applause. Thank you.